Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
In the mid-1800s, Londoners were in a bitter stalemate with the government. People had been forced into factories, working conditions were terrible, the hours were long, and the pay was next to nothing. This new era ushered in a new class system, which highlighted the huge disparity between working class people and those in the middle to upper classes. To make things even worse, the majority of people had no say in the matter, with only 4,500 people being allowed to vote in the whole of the country, which had a population of millions. Women in particular had realised this decision to not allow them to vote meant they were being continually downtrodden and their rights were non-existent. They had no right to divorce or birth control, and they were paid much less than their male counterparts. This universal message from the government was heard loud and clear, that 50% of the population were expected to do the lion's share of everything and yet weren't afforded the respect, safety and importance of men. Enough was enough, and if women wanted to be heard, they would have to use deeds, not words. Today on Macabre London, we uncover the story behind the bitter battle of Black Friday and the women who risked it all to gain everything. Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Macabre London. I'm Nikki Druce, your host with a silent G, and today I'll be taking you on a journey down another of London's grimy backstreets to uncover a macabre tale from the city's past. And today we're picking back up with part 3 in our series about the suffragettes and finding out about the battle which changed the course of the campaign. But first, if you're new here and you want to see more videos where we deep dive into historic tales from London's past, and sometimes all over the world, then please don't forget to subscribe or follow so you never miss a new episode. If you like what I make and have done for a while now, I have a Patreon where you can get more of the show. There is my extra podcast, which is exclusive to Patreon, called Having a Problem, which is lots of silly fun with a bit of history thrown in. And a new episode has just gone up over there, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. It really is the best way to support what I make to make sure the show can continue, and why not take a look on patreon.com/macabre London. The ongoing fight for universal suffrage had hit a turning point in 1884. For over 80 years, people had been fighting to get what they wanted, and this battle had permeated throughout subsequent generations, who equally fought to get their voices heard. The universal vote for everyone over the age of 21 was feeling like an impossible task to achieve. In the past two episodes of this mini-series around the Industrial Revolution and the path to universal suffrage, we've learned about how people in Manchester were attacked and killed by a rampaging cavalry at the Peterloo Massacre, where many people died as a result of their injuries, and thousands were arrested for criminal activity, despite the government ordering the attack. The ripple of the Peterloo Massacre caused an effect across the land which united working class people to fight for their rights, and over the next decades they would riot, strike and protest their way through the boggy trenches of justice to be rejected at every turn by those in power. The plight was long and arduous, and towards the end of the 1800s it seemed things were never going to get any better. But the darkest hour is right before the dawn, and if protesters wanted to break the system, they had to forge on, widening the cracks they'd already made within its delicate structure until they were too big to ignore. As the years had passed, the men who now began taking chairs as MPs were changing. A few previous reform acts had widened the narrow portion of people who could vote, and that meant the general opinions of the House was beginning to become more diverse. When John Stuart Mill took a seat as an MP, he became an insider for women. John was an ally to the women's suffrage movement and was of the opinion that getting women the vote was a surefire way to winning everyone the same rights. The Chartist movement, which had fought hard and long to make the small incremental improvements within the government, had now dissipated as their many attempts were rejected at making significant change. This led to universal suffrage movements popping up and also women's suffrage groups. Up until 1832, it was never written into law that voting for women was illegal, but the change made a demonstrable show that this marginalised group were now officially a long way off getting to where men were. This civil discourse created a huge increase in women's suffrage groups, and between 1866 and 1912, they spread across the whole of the UK in their hundreds. The groups were grassroots and represented the real breadth of women and men in the UK at that time. Alongside the standard suffrage groups were niche organisations such as the Actresses Franchise League, the Suffrage Atelier, and the Women's Tax Resistance League. These special interest groups were devised to capitalise on the many skills these suffrage fighters had and to put them to good use in making this a movement which infiltrated everything. If women worked in an industry, you can guarantee there was an offshoot suffrage group associated with it. The Actresses Franchise League used the performance and production skills of its members to provide entertainment for suffrage meetings to make them more enticing for people to attend. They created and choreographed plays around suffrage and made sure the processions and marches were executed with fine military precision. They also recruited the actresses who were at the top of their game and enticed audiences in using their star talent. Lily Langtry, in particular, was a big proponent of women's suffrage, and she would perform at awareness-raising events to draw in new audiences in the hope of getting them to enlist in the movement. A song was composed by Ethel Smythe, an accomplished composer, and the words were written by Cicely Hamilton, a journalist and playwright. This composition would become the official anthem for suffrage groups across the land and was used to rally women to join the cause and to keep their spirits high in times of endurance for the cause. The song, called The March of the Women, was sung proudly across the land and helped to give the cause a battle cry. The Suffrage Atelier was a group of designers, artists and professionals in arts and crafts. They created posters, branding, and paintings to help further the plight. Banners, posters, and pamphlets were designed to be beautiful and enticing, something which people would want to keep hold of and to show off. The Women's Tax Evasion Group focused on hitting the authorities where it hurt, their pockets. Their slogan was no vote, no tax, and these women were often arrested for not paying their dues. Many other societies which had a broader appeal also popped up. Jewish, Catholic, and general church suffrage groups used their religious links to spread the word. Industrial action groups used the network of factories and working class women to enlist everyday workers into the cause. There were even men's suffrage groups, which were created to demonstrate the allyship of their sisters, wives, mothers, friends, and colleagues. By this time, even though men were still fighting for suffrage, it became more focused on gaining women's suffrage, as this would ensure a better outcome for them as a whole. I won't make a joke here about sending a woman to get the job done, but it's not lost on me that it seems that way. However, this move towards gaining women's rights seems more about using a different tact. As the Chartist petitions over the years had been rejected, and now with more MPs in Parliament who understood the importance of votes for women, it seemed the turn of the tide was enacted to try and make things much fairer overall. It seemed the approach was to aim for the moon in the hope that they'd at least reach the stars. With such a huge increase in suffrage movements and the word spreading everywhere, one family group took it upon themselves to diversify things even more and to reassess the approach that had so far had limited success. The main leaders in the fight for women's suffrage had been run by Millicent Fawcett. She had taken over from Lydia Becker when she passed away, and the now 50-year-old stepped forward. Fawcett combined two suffrage groups to make the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, better known as the NUWSS, and more colloquially as the Suffragists. The NUWSS had been instrumental in a campaign of bombardment on the government. They had written thousands of letters, created and put forward hundreds of petitions, and were responsible for littering the country with the hundreds of regional suffrage groups which all fell under the umbrella of the NUWSS. Millicent was strong in her campaigning and a monumental leader. Her sister, Elizabeth Garrett, the country's first female doctor and surgeon, was also instrumental in heading up the cause, and the family and their friends were making great headway in getting the government's attention. However, this progress wasn't fast enough for some members of the group, with Millicent proclaiming that she had no plans to change the approach, saying the campaign had been like a glacier, slow moving, but unstoppable. This declaration ruffled some feathers within the organisation, and they decided that they would need to make even more noise to finally achieve the outcome they were looking for. And in order to do so, they would need to escape the indefatigable approach of the past and embrace a new militancy. After some discussions about adding a militant streak to the NUWSS, the members that suggested the tactic were told by Millicent that she didn't want to head in that direction as she thought it would hinder the plight. A number of the younger members of the group were beginning to realise that the older decision makers would never, in a month of Sundays, be up for creating the kind of necessary havoc they believed was required to advance the campaign. With a firm no to these new ideas, and this not being the answer they were looking for, respectfully, a family group who had been a loyal part of the suffragists decided they would break away and head to London to be closer to the action, and to begin carrying out more defiant and disruptive tasks. This family group were the Pankhursts. Mother Emmeline, her three daughters, Sylvia, Christabel and Adela, and Emmeline's husband, Richard. In 1866, the family moved to London. Things had been hotting up there, and it seemed that if they wanted their message to be heard, they needed to be closer to the men who made the decisions. Emmeline had grown up in a politically motivated family with parents who supported the workers' plight. Born in 1858 as Emmeline Goulden in Mossside in Manchester into a family which would eventually bear 10 children, Emmeline at an early age adopted the women's suffrage cause. At home, she read books and learned early about the French Revolution. She was frustrated that her intelligence was not utilised, and she found her brothers were often given all the opportunities where she was expected to learn homemaking skills, highlighting to her the difference between society's expectations of her and her brothers at a young age. The political ideals of equality were passed down to her, and perhaps despite her parents' limited beliefs of what women were capable of, the family did campaign for universal freedoms. They were proponents of the abolition of enslaved people in the US, and they believed women's suffrage was a worthwhile and important cause. Emmeline's mother took her along to a suffrage meeting where Lydia Becker was speaking in Manchester, and this was a turning point for young Emmeline. From that day onwards, Lydia's passion was contagious, and Emmeline felt the flame ignited within her core. Desperately wanting to go to France to be where the revolution had happened, Emmeline managed to secure a place at the École Normale de Neuilly, a school in Paris where at the age of 15 she was able to study far more interesting topics than she was afforded in Manchester. The school taught chemistry and bookkeeping to its female students, and Emmeline was thankful for the opportunity to try out something different. She did still have to partake in embroidery lessons, but the occasional chance to blow things up in a chemistry lab was a reasonable trade-off for her. At the age of 18, she was introduced to a Frenchman by her roommate, and she intended to marry him. However, the man asked Emmeline's father for a dowry to wed, and when it was refused, the man disappeared. This was an early lesson to Emmeline that she was to be considered property, and that next time she involved herself with a man, she would make sure it was for love and definitely not money. After her heartbreak, Emmeline returned to Manchester and continued with her aspirations of political power. She founded the Women's Franchise League, an early suffrage group, and worked across the country, spreading the word. At the age of 20, she met Richard Pankhurst. She first spotted him when he was arriving to a public meeting, climbing out of a cab, where she said she first noticed his beautiful hands. Richard was a barrister and had his own money, so he wasn't interested in Emmeline for anything other than love, and of course her tenacity and outspoken nature. He devised and wrote the Married Women's Property Acts of 1870 and 1882, which allowed women to keep earnings or property acquired before and after marriage. Before then, if a man decided to divorce a woman, because women couldn't do this themselves, then they could take everything, including property and children. As the rights of marriage were effectively a property acquisition, if a man decided they didn't want to have their wife as an asset anymore, they weren't beholden to give her anything. This meant that a lot of divorced women ended up with nothing and had to go to workhouses. It also meant women had no say in the process, and men could, if they wanted to, simply just get rid of their wives if they no longer wanted them or they found a better option. Richard himself never had any intention of marrying, and had in fact decided his life would be better used fighting for universal suffrage and within the realm of politics, so when Emmeline took a shine to him, she had to make the first move. Her mother chastised Emmeline for, in her words, throwing herself at Richard, saying she should be more aloof, but it worked, and she bagged the man she fancied the pants off. The two fell desperately in love, and they were a match made in heaven, despite quite an age difference. 44-year-old Richard married the 20-year-old Emmeline in 1879, after he convinced her that they needed to for her to be able to gain political standing. Originally, Emmeline didn't want to marry, as she felt it wasn't empowering to do so, and didn't want to become property. But she reconsidered when she realised that she would have more rights if she did. So, through gritted teeth, she carried out the legal union. Over the next few years, Emmeline and Richard focused on building a family, but aware that Emmeline should not just stay at home popping out kids, they employed a butler, which even though it was not 100% within their means, meant Emmeline could still work on her politics. Emmeline and Richard had five children, Christabel, Sylvia, Frank, Adela and Harry. Frank sadly passed away from diphtheria, and when she got pregnant with Harry, she believed this was Frank coming back to her, and so she christened him Harry Francis. The family were incredibly close-knit. Emmeline instilled her views in her daughters and her sons early on, and their father fostered the strength of the girls within the family, making sure they were well educated and providing a good homestead for the growing team. The Pankhurst family were good friends with Lanarkshire-born Keir Hardie, the founder of the Labour Party, and with some persuasion by the Pankhursts, by 1901, the team were all together in London to advance their political motives. Now, I know you're thinking it right now, and Keir Starmer is indeed named after Keir Hardie, so he clearly had no other option in life but to become the Labour Party leader, which is a kind of parental confidence my parents didn't have. I'm named after my sister's trampoline instructor, which is a true story. My sister was four and allowed to name me, and I think Big Nicky, the trampoline teacher, was the only other person she knew, and that explains why I'm bouncing on a trampoline right now. But this is a podcast, so you'll never know if that's true. But back to the story. Now, originally, Emmeline wanted to join the Independent Labour Party. However, her application was rejected due to her gender. But she did later on manage to join the wider party. When the Poor Law Amendment of 1834 was enacted, this changed the outlook for working class people, or those that had dropped below the breadline. The creation of workhouses and the removal of subsistence meant that anyone who couldn't work was forced into it via the cruelty of the workhouse. These thinly veiled prisons for the poor were even worse than the factory conditions, and in the north, the government didn't dare try to fully install them, as the civil unrest was already churning in that area of the country, and any further sanctions on freedoms would have inevitably caused a substantial uprising. The revision of the Poor Law was enacted due to the twisting of Jeremy Bentham's utilitarianism theories. Politicians believed that the doctrine of people seeking what brings them the most happiness meant people would always opt to carry out the easiest option presented to them, believing the poor would choose subsistence, or benefits as we would call them nowadays, over work. The workhouses were brought in to try and combat a problem which in all reality wasn't really there, and this harsh overreaction was responsible for hundreds if not thousands of deaths. This was a systematic eradication of the poor. Emmeline worked as a guardian for the poor laws and was dismayed at the conditions of the workhouses. And with her first-hand experiences of seeing people be affected by it, she and Richard became increasingly left-wing. This led to some upset within the wider family, as Emmeline's parents didn't believe that Richard was going in the best direction, and thought he was becoming extreme, so they decided the best thing to do if they really wanted to make a difference was to move to London and to distance themselves from the north. In London, the family's home in Russell Square became a hub of political activity. The pair welcomed people from all over the world, including revolutionaries and activists who were fighting the good fight. The Pankhurst home was decorated in a way to make everyone feel welcome. It was decorated with art from all over the world, and guests were treated as part of the family when they were there. Emmeline's daughter Sylvia said of the home, Beauty and appropriateness in her dress and household appointments seemed to her at all times an indispensable setting to public work.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Over the next few years, the Pankhursts had to split their time between London and Manchester due to the majority of Richard's clients being in the northwest. With increasing pressure to try and shut down the Independent Labour Party by the government, who didn't like the support it was receiving, the plight was proving to be too much for Richard, and in his advancing years, he was struggling with his health. After Emmeline was threatened with imprisonment over attending a covert ILP meeting in a wood in Manchester, Richard had to defend her and two of his fellow activists. After this stressful time, Richard developed a gastric ulcer. However, he did recover for a short while, but when Emmeline had gone on a brief break to Switzerland with the children to see her old roommates from her school in Paris, Richard sent a letter to her saying he was not feeling well and she should return home as soon as she could. Whilst Emmeline was on a train, she picked up a discarded newspaper to distract herself, but sadly, there in bold print, she learned that she was too late. As the press informed her, Richard had died. Distraught and grief-stricken, Emmeline now found herself with a whole family to care for, with her income halved. She downsized the home and moved them into a mid-sized Victorian terrace house in Manchester, which still survives today as a museum called the Pankhurst Centre. She changed jobs to a higher paid but more flexible role, working as a registrar for births and deaths. She then obtained a place on the school board and reopened a family-run fabric shop. The fabric shop had been trialled in London alongside Emmeline's sister Mary, but it hadn't done fantastically well, and it was decided it would be shut. However, with still some stock lying around and short on money, she decided to reopen it, with the help of the children to run it. Over the next few years, the Pankhursts distanced themselves from the genteel yet stoic attempts at gaining women's suffrage by the NUWSS. Millicent Fawcett, despite being initially opposed to anything more extreme, did suggest that a new society which could be mobilised as such might be a good idea. She did say that violence shouldn't be a part of it, but a mild bit of performative nuisance would definitely draw attention to the plight. With this in mind, Emmeline began the Women's Social and Political Union on the 10th of October 1903, which had become better known as the WSPU. Even though the bulk of the activities were happening in this initial stage in London, the scourge of womankind was not going unnoticed across the country. Since the emergence of the movement in Manchester, pockets of supporters had popped up everywhere. Groups were being mobilised, and this political activist campaign was growing and sending out feelers to the most disenfranchised of women and gaining their support. The movement took 2 years of careful planning. The same bombardment of petitions, speeches, and constant letters was still happening, but Emmeline and her daughters were growing impatient. If things were going to change, there was no other option than to make more noise. The plan was to begin affecting things that the men in power cared about, and to do it without men's backing. The WSPU was a women's-only organisation, and the fight was to be fought by the people that had first-hand experience of the inequality they faced. This extreme capitalistic behaviour of those in power meant that they were led by their property and income, and in order to be truly heard, the WSPU had to destroy or at least impact significantly on those areas and hit them where it hurt the most, their pockets. Emmeline coined the phrase deeds, not words, and this would become the motto of the WSPU. By this time, the press, which had now become dominated by those not in favour of reform, as those who were, had not been allowed to publish papers and spread their message far and wide. Independent printing presses were destroyed, and anything considered left-wing was stopped from printing by either arresting those involved and putting them in prison, or by confiscating equipment. The papers had been voicing an anti-reform message, particularly against women, with the general thought being men spoke for their women, so therefore they did have a voice, and so they used their publishing powers to try and quash women's voices at every turn. In order to try and belittle the WSPU, they called them suffragettes and doubted their campaign publicly. This, however, had the opposite effect. It branded the women with a title, and they embraced it, much to the paper's chagrin. The name had everything they needed. The et on the end made it a feminine word, and the suffrage was still in there. It perfectly summed up exactly what they were all about. Emmeline rolled with it, which meant every time they tried to belittle the WSPU, they were doing them a favour by saying the name of their plight, thus spreading more awareness across the country and into the homes that needed to hear it the most. After all, you can't use a word as an insult if it isn't one. Emmeline began using the group's motto, deeds, not words, to begin conveying what would happen if the government didn't listen. But of course, the threat wasn't heeded, and so the WSPU had no other option but to turn things up a notch. During this time, things began hotting up within the WSPU, and every time they were denied time for suffrage in Parliament to be discussed, they retaliated. In 1905, a women's suffrage bill was introduced to Parliament, but ran out of time to be heard as a particular opponent from the Liberal Party decided to deliberately filibuster the bill. This intentional overspeaking was met with anger and disdain by those in support of the bill, who just so happened to be gathered outside in Parliament Square. This soon turned into a loud and angry protest against Parliament. Police intervened and initially successfully disbanded the crowd of women. However, they regrouped and marched defiantly back to the same spot and continued to shout loudly. Even though this protest wasn't successful in getting the bill through Parliament, Emmeline Pankhurst attributed it to the first successful militant act the WSPU carried out, and said that they were finally receiving the political recognition they deserved, even if the outcome wasn't what they wanted. Despite the scepticism of Millicent Fawcett and the NUWSS, the WSPU were proving it was in fact deeds, not words, that was advancing the plight's progress faster than the action had before. This inciting incident started a chain reaction, and the police began a systematic series of arrests whenever possible to hinder the plight and to act as a deterrent to any other militant women. The first woman to be arrested directly as a result of protesting women's suffrage was Annie Kenny, a Manchester woman who was part of the WSPU. The second person to be arrested was Christabel Pankhurst, Emmeline's eldest daughter. She spat at a heavy-handed policeman and quickly found herself sequestered in Strangeways Prison for an overnight stay. The WSPU spent a lot of time trying to get arrested. The more members that got arrested, the more column inches they got in the papers. For this reason, Emmeline herself would deliberately assault police officers, running up and slapping them around the face completely unprovoked, just with the goal being to end up in prison. Emmeline truly led by example, and over the whole time as leader of the WSPU, she ended up behind bars 8 times. This example of deeds in action inspired the younger faction of the WSPU to make an even more militant offshoot of the group called the Young Hot Bloods, which, if that's not a punk band name, I don't know what is. This gang of under-30s, who formed in 1907, were in charge of danger duty within the WSPU, but we'll be exploring exactly what that meant and the militancy disruption these women caused in the next episode. Over the next few years, things would become much harder for the WSPU, and alongside them, their less militant sisters would still be continuing their unwavering campaign. Women were now regularly being placed in prison for longer sentences, and the WSPU called for them to go on hunger strike. This meant many women were stuck behind bars and threatening to martyr themselves, which the government couldn't afford. However, I'm not going to get into the meat of that just now, as it will be explored in the next episode. With these brave women behind bars, so far those who weren't in support of the suffrage movement couldn't understand the self-flagellation they were inflicting upon themselves. But the longer they stuck to their guns, starved themselves, brawled in the streets with policemen, and shouted from their soapboxes, it was clear they weren't going away anytime soon. Finally, by 1910, there was some movement within the government, and the topic of women's suffrage had become a regular debate in Parliament. However, just as things were moving forward, the plight received a huge knockback. In 1910, the first Reconciliation Bill failed in Parliament. This bill was a precursor to the later Representation of the People Act. This resulted in a turning point which would culminate in a huge event, the likes of which would become the suffragettes' own Peterloo Massacre, the Black Friday riot. On the 18th of November 1910, the day the Reconciliation Bill was due to be passed, this legislation would allow a small number of women to vote, and so the outcome was highly anticipated. Parliament Square was attended by over 300 women who were crossing their fingers in the hopes of good news. The protest began as a demonstration of frustration with the reigning Liberal Party. In a manipulative decision, they called an unexpected election to improve the mandate for their people's budget, something which the general public had no say in. The Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, refused to grant it further parliamentary time, despite the bill having passed the second and third readings in Parliament, and instead decided to dissolve Parliament on the 28th of November as he felt the budget was more important. Just as a little aside here, interestingly, Asquith is Helena Bonham Carter's great-grandfather, and she played Elizabeth Garrett Anderson in the film Suffragette. So I like to think she has righted the wrongs within that family tree by doing so. Anyway, back to Parliament Square. This snap decision knowingly threatened the progress of the Consolation Bill, which, if passed, would have given a small number of women the vote and would be an essential step towards universal suffrage as a whole. So this defiant act by the Prime Minister demonstrated yet again that women were not a priority to the country, and still treated as second-class citizens. This backtracking resulted in the WSPU asking to meet with Prime Minister Henry Asquith to get his answer, and so he could tell them to their faces. As part of the bill, women had been requested to give their testimonies, but had decided to arrive at Parliament Square in smaller numbers of less than 12. This deliberate act would stop police from dispersing them, as they weren't breaking the Riot Act by doing so. But, of course, this drip of groups of 12 soon built into the 300-strong crowd, which was now incredibly angry at the outcome of the parliamentary meeting. So they decided to take matters into their own hands and gain access to the building. First up to try and enter Parliament were Emmeline Pankhurst, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, and Princess Sophia Duleep Singh, the three top dogs of the WSPU. Unlike her sister Millicent, Elizabeth had sided with the more militant faction of the suffragettes. These three bastions of female reform were refused entry and told that the Prime Minister had decided against hearing from any of the WSPU that day. Now, I'm sure you've already guessed this, but Asquith was heavily against women's suffrage and didn't want to entertain any opposition to his unchangeable mind. Others in his party, such as the then Home Secretary, Winston Churchill, also backed up his affirmations of unsubstantiated misogynistic fear and initiated the resistance against the women. As the further groups of 12 arrived, it didn't take long before the women numbered in their hundreds outside in Parliament Square. This entrapment of the majority of the WSPU, which may or may not have been intentional, meant that the police had 300 women in a confined area with which they could do what they wanted, and having been fired up by the Prime Minister, they were hungry for blood. It seemed word had got out quickly about the gathering of suffragettes, and the misogynistic intentions of local men and the police soon became apparent. Many men gathered with the intention of harming the women, and the police were all too happy to oblige. The police aided in removing some women from the crowd and throwing them to the men for them to do with as they wanted. Women were assaulted violently by the gangs, groped, thrown to the ground, or lifted up and carried away. By this time, the police on the ground had gone into a frenzy, and they had forgotten their initial orders to defend Parliament. Members of the WSPU began climbing the railings, all while the police were busy attacking women in the crowd. Truncheons were used to attack the women, and many were struck around the head and body repeatedly. Some gangs of police and also men from the crowd, who some presume were off-duty policemen, were seen carrying women into alleyways and assaulting them there in gangs. This vicious attack was a demonstration of hate towards these brave and intolerant women, and the thinly veiled argument of the authorities trying to protect Parliament was unfounded, as they simply weren't. In fact, it seemed that the most violent police officers had been drafted in, particularly from the East End of London, a part of the force who were notoriously known for being as bad as the criminals they were going after. Many women reported having their skirts lifted, men tripping them over, and plainclothed policemen in the crowd were deliberately inciting assaults, telling men to grab women around their chests, whilst others held their arms behind their backs or tackled them to the floor. One suffragette, May Billingshurst, who used a wheelchair, was tipped out of it by police, and when eventually she was helped back into it, they then pushed her away with her arms behind her back whilst bending her fingers back before dumping her in an alleyway and deflating the tyres before telling some men to do as they wished with her. Luckily, May actually found the men in the alleyway were not intent on causing her harm and happened to actually not be there to cause trouble at all, unlike many others that day, and she said they actually helped her to get away. The women, which didn't manage to escape, were kettled into the space for 6 hours and subjected to continual abuse from police and male bystanders. This type of punishment was unprecedented, and eventually Winston Churchill had to issue orders for the police to cease their actions to avoid fatalities. This demonstration of male violence against these women was a deliberate attempt to silence them from further protesting, and the tactics used were abhorrent and allowed to go unpunished by the offenders. However, the women that were attacked that day were. 114 of the protesters were arrested that day, but as the accusatory right-wing press published stories against the women, they did incriminate the men who attacked them, with one paper saying the police seemed to be enjoying fighting the women. This display of unnecessary violence made many people change their ideas of what the suffragettes were doing, and that even though they were being loud and that they might not agree with their politics, they didn't deserve to be beaten. The following day, and with the waves of discourse rippling throughout the city, the rising threat of backlash and a similar descent onto Parliament from the suffragettes' male supporters was making the Liberal Party sweat. Winston Churchill decided to null and void the arrests, calling a performatory truce, and let the women go without charge. The condemnable actions of the police were investigated by MPs that were pro-women's suffrage. Statements were collected from eyewitnesses at the event and compiled into an inquiry request pamphlet, but these attempts at gaining an official investigation were disallowed by Churchill. In counter documents, others, who I'm assuming were police officers, claimed the suffragettes were riling up the police and attacked them first with extreme force. This counter-argument was used to justify the lack of investigation, but the whole scenario blotted the copybook of the police and the Liberal Party and made the suffrage argument even stronger as a result. The after-effects from Black Friday would rumble on for those who were attacked that day. Around 50 women sustained injuries that required medical attention, and some were even hurt so badly that their subsequent deaths were attributed to the violence they endured. Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, who was in her 70s at this point, decided to step away from her militant sisters in action after Black Friday, and the lasting psychological damage for some of those attacked was enough for them to step away from their duties altogether. The two women that died after the event, with their deaths being attributed to Black Friday, were Mary Clark and Henria Williams. Emmeline's sister, Mary Clark, the leader of the WSPU's Brighton branch, died just a matter of weeks after from a brain hemorrhage. And Henria, who already had a weak heart, said she had to fight for her life when a policeman beat her for minutes on end. She said she had no other option but to attack him as hard as she could, to break free, or else she knew he would kill her there and then. The events of Black Friday, whilst it didn't have a direct effect on legislation, did a lot to raise the profile of the women's suffrage movement. The actions of the overzealous police and attackers showed that even though these women were battered and bruised, they were willing to do anything and everything to gain their rights. If the men wanted to fight, they'd fight them, physically and mentally. The sheer determination of the suffragettes showed that day was a demonstration of their power. With the movement growing and gaining power, these outspoken and powerful women were starting to scare the men into reason, and their fears of women causing society to fall if they had a say was proving to be the opposite. If women didn't get a say, then they would make society fall. This 50% of the population had had enough, and if they joined together to outright refuse anything men asked of them, they would destroy life as they knew it, and everyone was starting to realise this was the case. The broiling anger that can only be built throughout years of systematic oppression and sexism was now being used to fuel a machine that would keep churning all the while the fuel of inequality was being used to stoke the flames. Even though the tactics of the women's suffrage groups would differ, this united message was starting to turn the tide, but those in control would do everything within their power to try and stop this onward movement, but the floodgates could only withstand so much before they would burst. And soon they would, but it would take more brutality, endurance, and strength to finally win the fight. Next time on Macabre London, and in our final part of this suffragette mini-series, we'll be learning about the last pushes to win the vote, the interesting techniques used by the WSPU to intimidate and cause damage, and the horrors of being a political prisoner in the Edwardian era, all with a side of kung fu, explosives, and honour badges. Oh, and a brief interlude from a little something called World War I. So make sure you join me then to round off this fascinating period in London's history. for this mammoth episode, and sorry this one is a little bit later than I expected. I think I might have been overdoing it somewhat recently and trying to have too many irons in the fire, and I've had a bit of life stuff going on as well, so I appreciate you being patient and allowing me to rest and to deliver the next installment of this series, which I've been loving creating, and I hope you can tell. Make sure you're subscribed or following to keep up with the next installment and to see how the story ends. These episodes have taken weeks of writing and research so far, and it's somewhat taken it out of me, so if you want to help me out and to say thanks for the content, then I have a Patreon where you can find extra content too, like my bonus podcast, Having a Problem, which I've just released a new episode of over there, and you'll be directly contributing to help me make more mini-series like this one for you. Head to patreon.com/macabrelondon to take a look. Go on, there's no harm in looking, and I know you're curious. Make sure you head over to YouTube to take a look at these episodes if you've not already done so. It really adds faces to names in the story, and you get to see many of the people I talk about, plus me hosting the show as well. A big thanks to my amazing top-tier legendary executive Patreon producers, Christina, Christoph, Kate, Lisa, Mary, Ravel, Sally, Sam, Sarah, Terry, Teresa, V, and Veronica, and all of our other patrons too. If you'd also like your name read out by me at the end of every episode or your name in the show notes, then signing up to Patreon is the way to make that happen. I hope to see you over there at patreon.com/macabrelondon so I can personally welcome you to the Ghoul Gang. Thanks for joining me for another macabre tale from London's past. I've been Nikki Druce. Remember to stay spooky, and I'll see you ghouls next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.